originating from our Jimmy John's of Lexington studios. This is Jock Talk, presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka on the Horse Racing Radio Network. An intimate, in-depth discussion with the best jockeys in thoroughbred racing.
25-year-old Mario Gutierrez, who took Derby 1:38.
Digging down for the final 16th under Victor Espinosa.
Joe Calamo in the ride of his life, in the race of his life.
Gary Stevens, 3 Preaknesses.
A brilliant ride by Calvin Burrell.
Up the inside under Johnny Velasquez to take it.
Shanghai Bobby and Rosina Pradnik come again to beat. He's had enough.
Raji Barrage aboard, crushing the field here.
Perfectly ridden by Javier Castellano. A scintillating performance under Rafael Bejarano.
Now, here's Christina McManigal.
Hello again, everyone, and welcome to Jock Talk, presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka, right here on the Horse Racing Radio Network. I'm your host, retired jockey Christina McManigal, and I'm joining you tonight from our Jimmy John's of Lexington, Kentucky studio. I would like to thank everyone listening tonight on Sirius 219 XM 201, and also to those of you tuning into our website. That's www.horseracingradio.net. A portion of the proceeds from this show go to the Permanently Disabled Jockeys Fund. The PDJF provides financial assistance to riders who have suffered devastating on-track injuries. If you are able to help, I encourage you to visit their website at www.pdjf.org. So our guest tonight, he won not only the Kentucky Derby, but he won the Epsom Derby twice, the French Derby, the Irish Derby, the Italian Derby, the Welsh Derby, and the Scottish Derby. In 1977, he won both the Eclipse Award for Outstanding Apprentice and the Eclipse Award for Outstanding Jockey. He also won the British Champion Jockey title 3 times. And in 1978, he won the Triple Crown with Affirmed. With 2,794 wins, a 19.1% win percentage, it is an honor to introduce jockey Steve Cawthon. Steve, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Christina. Good to be with you.
So great to have you here on the show, Steve. I've been dying to get you on the show for a long time. Can't wait to hear your story. And right now I'm sitting in Lexington, Kentucky, and you're actually not too far up the state a little bit of a ways. You grew up in Kentucky.
I did. I was born in Covington, and we moved down to New Orleans when I was young. My dad was a blacksmith, and he shod horses at the fairgrounds. We lived there for a couple years. Then we had moved to Oklahoma for a year, and then we moved back to New Orleans, and then bought a small farm up here in 65, 40-acre farm in Walton, Kentucky, and that's pretty much where I was raised, me and my brothers, until I started riding, and around the world, and then back to Verona, Kentucky, which is the town right next to Walton. So went full circle.
Yeah, you returned to your roots, and so as a young boy, you got a taste of that gypsy lifestyle that is the racetrack. And did you ever have any aspirations of doing anything else other than being involved in the racetrack or being a jockey?
I think when I was, younger in school, growing up, at one point I wanted to be an NFL quarterback. didn't take long for me to figure out that wasn't probably going to work. It was probably about 12 years old that I really kind of set my mind that I wanted to try to become a jockey. And my dad, agreed to help me. And, we pretty much, the first thing I did was start working on a farm, breaking, young horses, which, was probably about the best experience you can have to, learn, how to become a jockey. It was, great for me to, learn how to get into the minds of the young horses and figure out how to best get along with them and get them to do what I wanted them to do.
How old were you?
After that, I was 12. when I started, I'm thinking it was like the summer of between seventh and eighth grade. And then I worked there again, the next couple summers. And then the summer I was 15, I illegally worked at River Downs, Galloping Horses. But which I can say now because I think it's past, 7 years or however long it is. But, it was a good experience that I was able to get, because, it's just hard to get, that track experience, And so really when I did, I turned 16, I went back to school that winter. And when I turned 16, I was, really ready to start riding. Although I still looked like I was about 12 or 10 and a half, 10 or 11. And I remember Keen Dangerfield, who was the state steward at the time, looked over the desk at me and my dad, and he said, "I'm going to have to think about this." I don't think he really believed I was 16, but eventually, he realized that I actually was 16. And he talked to the starter at Churchill, who seen me come out of the gate, and everybody that he talked to said that they thought I was okay and ready to ride. And so when I was 10 or 11 days later, I got my first mount on May the 12th at Churchill Downs.
May 12th at Churchill Downs. We're coming up on that anniversary, Steve. I heard a funny story that your coach in high school, I think it was your basketball coach, told you that you wouldn't be able to make a very good living as a jockey.
Well, he didn't tell me. We were all sitting around, I was playing basketball at the time. And I can't remember if it was gym class or basketball, but he was just asking everybody what they were thinking about doing. And I said, "I think I want to be a jockey." And he laughed. I didn't take that real kindly. I said, "I think I can make a good living if I can, be one of the leading riders at River Downs." And, he laughed. And anyway, a couple of years later, I came back for the homecoming, and that was after I won the Triple Crown. So
wow.
He kind of, he looked askew at me, and I laughed. I got the last laugh.
Got the last laugh is right. And so you rode your first race at Churchill Downs. And tell us about that experience as a young 16-year-old boy and riding your first race at Churchill. And what was that like?
Well, it was obviously exciting. I think anybody who was looking forward to becoming a jockey as much as I was, getting your first chance to get in the gate and do it for real is, tremendously exciting. I obviously had, galloped millions of horses. I'd, worked a lot of horses. I'd broken out of the gate a zillion times. But, it's different when it's a real race, and you're up against real jockeys and, at Churchill Downs as well, which was a big deal. I was riding a horse called King of Swat. He was basically had been, just gotten back from a long vacation at the farm, and, he was probably fit to go about half a mile. And, the trainer, told me that beforehand, I was just happy to get in the gate. So, he broke. I remember just, the break, it was all like that. At that time, it was like just all happening so fast for me because it was my first time. I think after, people that have ridden, for a while, it all kind of happens in slow motion because your mind, learns to work so fast that everything, it's like a baseball player, getting a pitch, after you've done it for a while, it all happens more in slow motion for you compared to like a normal person. But obviously my first race, it all seemed like it was flying by, but, the horse broke well and I was laying second down the backside and, halfway around the turn and then, he lost his breath.
Lost his breath. And then...
And, he ended up finishing, last or second last. But, it was a great first experience.
Yeah, I can relate, Steve. I rode my first race at Churchill Downs, and I finished last as well. But you were so excited to be there, it doesn't really matter.
Yeah, that's true. Yep, for sure.
How long until you won your first race?
Well, so I rode, I think that was the 12th, and then I rode a couple more horses the next day at Churchill. And, yeah, they finished 5th and, you know, 6th, you know, middle of the pack. And I think I maybe rode one more day there and rode one other horse. And my uncle called me and said, I've got a horse at River Downs that, you know, I think has a chance to win if you want to come up and ride him. And I said, hell yeah. I said, I'm tired of finishing, you know, in the middle of the pack. So I went up and rode this horse called Red Pipe that my uncle trained, and turned out my future lawyer owned it, a guy called Don Warshire, and he broke, and halfway down the backside, it was a 5.5 furlong dirt race, and it was a muddy day, and he broke, and you know, he was like 20 lengths out of it after a furlong, you know. I was like, oh crap, what a waste of time this was. And then all of a sudden I could feel him starting to pick up, you know, and he, you know, basically halfway around the turn, I was cruising and, you know, just eased him out. And, you know, he ran on one by a couple lengths, and, you know, it was a great feeling. So it was just, you know, like you said, just to know, you know, you start to wonder if you really, you know, you're as good as you thought you were. You know, when you keep, you know, finishing the middle of the pack or down in the back, you know. So it was nice to know that, yeah, with the right horse, I could win a race.
Was your family there to watch that victory?
Oh, yeah. My dad, my mom, my brothers, aunts and uncles. You know, just so happened, you know, that everybody that was around, you know, they showed up. And like I said, my uncle trained the horse, and my cousins were there. They were, you know, young, and a couple of my cousins. And so, yeah, there was probably about 25 people in the wind picture that were mostly my relatives.
Wow. Well, and your career pretty much took off from there, Steve. Tell us where you went from there.
Well, so the next day, my mom had a horse in a race up there, and I rode it, and it won, called Mary McCullough. I'm trying to remember his name, but another trainer gave me a mount the following day that won. And from that point on, you know, basically everybody, you know, couldn't get to me fast enough. You know, all of a sudden they realized they could get somebody who could ride a little bit and was getting, you know, 7 pounds off at that point, or 10, I guess, and then, you know, 7 and then 5. But, you know, pretty much from that point on, it started taking off, you know, and I was riding 2 or 3 winners a day. And, well, in 2 months, I rode over 100 winners. So.
Wow, that's incredible. And didn't you, speaking of the weight, weren't you extremely light when you first started riding?
I was like 92 pounds, something like that.
So I'm guessing they had to put lead in your saddle.
Oh, yeah. I had plenty of lead pads. And I had at that time I didn't have that saddle because eventually when I got up to New York, I got an old saddle from Braulio Baeza that obviously he didn't need anymore because he was getting heavy. But he used to, well, I guess when he first started, he was fairly light, and he had this saddle, which is the saddle I won the Triple Crown on. And, you know, you could put, you know, the big lead weights inside the saddle, and then you didn't have to have so much of the lead in the saddle pad, you know, the lead pad, you know, because sometimes the lead pad could slip, you know, it was just more, I felt more secure having, you know, most of the weight in my, you know, flaps in my saddle. So, yeah, it had its own, it probably rigged up about probably 15 pounds, just the, you know, the saddle with the weight in it, the lead weight in it. So it was good.
Jockey Steve.
And I got it hanging on my wall in a nice trophy box.
That's awesome. Jockey Steve Cawthon joining me tonight on Jock Talk, presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka right here on the Horse Racing Radio Network. So, Steve, when did you decide to go to New York?
Well, so I went to, so I was at River Downs for, you know, like I said, a couple months, because my birthday was in May. So I started, you know, I think I rode my first winter up there on May 17th. And there was about 2 months left of the meet, two and a bit, maybe a little bit more than 2 months. And so when that meet was over, I went to Chicago, and I was there. I started the meet about halfway through it and ended up second leading rider there at Arlington behind Larry Snyder, who was obviously the perennial, you know, lead guy there. And then I went ahead and went over to Hawthorne and rode at that meet and ended up second leading rider to him again. And then I came back to the Churchill meet for the fall meet, and I think I was second leading rider to Donnie Brumfield, who obviously was, you know, the, you know, all around leader in to Churchill back in those days. And then I sat there thinking, you know, do I get what, you know, what should I do? Should I go to Florida or should I go to New York? And I actually was talking to Donnie Brumfield and Eddie Delahousie, who were both riding the Churchill fall meet. And they said, you know, the winter's a good time to break into New York, you know, because all those guys go to Florida, you know, it's a good time to try to break in there. So that made my decision for me, and I decided to go to New York. Unfortunately, that year, Cordero and Velasquez and Vasquez and Turcotte, they all stayed up in New York. But in the end, it didn't really matter. Things still took off for me up there. But they helped me, you know, make that decision, those guys. And, you know, me and Eddie were longtime friends. He was a great guy.
Yeah, it didn't really matter, Steve, because in 77, as I mentioned in the introduction, you won both the Eclipse Award for Outstanding Apprentice and the Eclipse for Outstanding Jockey. Has that ever happened before?
I don't really know. I couldn't tell you. But
I don't think so.
Probably not often.
I don't think so. Definitely not. Not only to be, you know, young and just starting out, but then to be the seasoned journeyman as well in the country. I mean, that had to be just such a proud moment for you when you earned those awards. What were you thinking as a kid who was from a small town in Kentucky? Did you ever have any idea you would make it to that level?
No, I obviously, you know, like I said, originally when I, you know, I was thinking, you know, I'd like to be leading rider at River Down someday. So, you know, that was kind of, you know, I wasn't really setting my goals too high at the beginning, but at the same time, you know, you have to kind of, you know, reset your goals as things happen. And so I kept resetting my goals, and, you know, but, you know, at that time, I think, you know, I was obviously, you know, my family was all with me, and, you know, I was proud to have my parents, you know, see me, you know, being successful. You know, that was really what was important to me, and to just have my family around me. So, yeah, it was really cool. You know, like you said, to get, you know, that. And I also, that year, I also won the third one, which was the Award of Merit, which is supposedly for, you know, the person who's done a lot for racing that year.
Wow.
So that was even, you know, probably the most important one of all.
When you mentioned talking to Don Brumfield and Eddie Delahousie, and I've had both of those gentlemen on the show, and such great mentors for you, I'm sure, as a young rider. And so during that first year riding, who else in the room kind of took you under their wing or showed you the ropes? Anyone to mention?
Well, up at River Downs, there was a jockey named Guillermo Milord, and he was a really good rider. He was also a tough rider to ride against, because, you know, he was he didn't cut anybody any breaks, but I sure did learn a lot from him. So, you know, I had to say, you know, mention him there. You know, I had all kinds of guys that, you know, were Bernie Sailor was a friend of mine. I actually worked for his brother, Jim Sailor, the year before. You know, Perry Utes was, you know, basically, you know, I you know, you learn by keeping your eyes open and your mouth shut, you know, and kind of just watching what people actually do, you know, and actually observing, you know, how they ride and, you know, what kind of moves they make. And, you know, basically the best jockeys are the guys who make the least mistakes, you know. That's what it really comes down to. I mean, obviously there's guys that look better on horses than me, you know, that could, you know, use a stick or switch their stick better than me. But, you know, overall, I did everything pretty well, you know, and so you just, you know, you don't make mistakes and you win a lot of races that, you know, sometimes other guys wouldn't win. So that's really what I focused on, was just kind of learning from everybody. Yeah, and I learned some things from guys that I didn't think were great riders, but there were certain things that they did well, you know.
What would you say you were best known for as a rider? Was it?
You know, I think probably the two things that I was best known for was being still on a horse and having a good judge of pace.
Both very important things. And that last, judging a pace, that's, for me anyway, it was one of the most difficult things, I would say, for me to learn. And how did that come easy to you? How did you get used to that, judging the pace?
You know, I worked horses, and I basically, you know, I would get to, you know, where I would try to figure out how fast I was going, and I, you know, every time I'd come back, I'd say, this is how fast I went, you know, and then they'd tell me what, how fast I really went, and it wasn't, you know, after a while, I just, I got to where I could, you know, I was really usually very rarely out, you know, more than a fifth or two-fifths of a second, you know, from how fast I'd gone. And, of course, you know, obviously, you know, from time to time I'd get fooled. You know, if you're riding, you know, a really good horse, sometimes, you know, because it's, you know, part of it is, you know, you feel how easy you're going, how much effort they're putting into it. And sometimes, you know, a good horse can fool you because they're going faster than they seem like they're going. You know, they just glide. But overall, you know, most of the time I could tell pretty close to, you know, what I was doing. And it's just really just a feel, a sense of, you know, like you said, inner timing clock, I guess, that you kind of, you know, you work on to, you know, get it perfected, you know, as best you can.
You said a really good horse could trick you. So let's talk about a really good horse you rode, Steve, Affirmed. And
yeah.
Tell us how the story began for you. How did you first get the mount?
Well, I was up in New York, obviously doing really well, leading into the season of 77. And I had a bad fall on opening day at Belmont where five horses went down over top of me. My horse broke down and, you know, fell, and five horses went over top of me. And, I woke up in the, you know, hospital, and, you know, I knew it wasn't good because my mom was there, and she'd been in Kentucky before the race, so I knew I must have been out for a while. But anyway, I was out for about a month, and when I came back, the first horse I rode was a horse called Little Miracle. And that was the first horse I rode for Laz Barrera. And it just also happens to be a half brother to Affirmed, but I didn't know that at the time. I didn't know anything about Affirmed at the time. But anyway, I won on him, and I won, you know, the next day I actually lost my bug and I won three races. So got back onto a good start, you know, once I got back from my fall. And, you know, I rode a couple other horses for Laz, I think, at the Belmont meet. And then, you know, the next thing you know, we're up at Saratoga. And while I'd been gone, a kid called Bernie Gonzalez had ridden him in his first race. Supposedly I was supposed to ride him in his first race, but I, you know, for whatever reason, I didn't. Well, I mean, I didn't because I'd fallen, you know, I was out. But because I think he actually ran a few days after my fall. And then after that, Cordero rode him and won a stake on him at Belmont. And then he was second to Aladar in another stake. And then Affirm went out to California and ran in the Hollywood you know, whatever it was, juvenile or something, and won by 8 lengths with Tim Kai on him. So he came back to Saratoga, you know, for the summer meet at Saratoga, and I guess they asked Angel if he wanted to ride him, and he decided that he, you know, obviously he hadn't impressed him that much. I mean, he had a horse called Tilt Up that Leroy Jolly had, and he picked him over Affirmed. And I guess they asked Ben Kai if he wanted to come out. And, of course, you know, Saratoga is a long way and a hard place to get to from L.A. You know, you got to fly into New York and then up to Saratoga. And I think at the time the race he was going for, the Sanford, was probably like a $40,000 or $50,000 stake race. So he decided to pass, and so I was third choice that day, and I got the call, and I went and worked him, and he really didn't impress me too much. But
really?
He, you know, I knew he was obviously a nice horse. He'd already won a stake, and you know, he won the Sanford, and I again, you know, he won, but I wasn't overly impressed. You know, that I didn't get off of him that day thinking, you know, this is the best horse I've ever ridden. And we came back 3 weeks later for the Hopeful, and that was the first time he ran against Aladar that day. And, you know, everything was going fine. I was sitting, you know, third, I think, most of the race, and then I eased up, you know, was kind of, you know, aiming to take the lead, you know, turned into the stretch, and then all of a sudden here came Aladar. And when he joined me, you know, the two horses just took off like a rocket. And I've never, you know, like you said, that was, you know, that last 3/16 of a mile down the Saratoga stretch was what told me, you know, not only was I on a good horse, but that, you know, the horse next to me was good too, you know. So that was the beginning of my experience with the Affirmed Aladar, you know, rivalry.
Well, folks, we are going to hear more about Affirmed after this very short commercial break. Stay with us. You are listening to Jock Talk, presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka, right here on the Horse Racing Radio Network.
Hi, I'm Tito Beveridge, founder and master distiller of Tito's Handmade Vodka, America's original craft vodka. I believe in the craft process of distilling in batches using old-fashioned pot stills, and that's the way we still make Tito's Handmade Vodka today. We even won the World Spirits Competition, double gold, unanimous judge's choice. Tito's Handmade Vodka is made from 100% corn, so it's naturally gluten-free. For recipes, videos, and more, visit titosvodka.com. 80 proof Tito's Handmade Vodka, 5th Generation Inc., distilled and bottled in Austin, Texas.
Hi, I'm John Velasquez.
And I'm Julian Lepau. Every jockey knows and accepts the risk of a sport every time they get a leg up on the horse.
Although catastrophic on-track accidents are rare, when they do happen, the lives of the jockeys and their family change forever.
It's up to all of us in racing to support these men and women.
That's why we support the Permanent Disabled Jockey Fund. Since its founding in 2006, the PDJF has disbursed over $8 million to over 75 permanently disabled jockeys.
Over 90 cents out of every dollar donated goes directly to these brave men and women.
They use their monthly stipend to pay bills, hire caretakers, and many other things that make living with a permanent disability just a bit easier.
This is Mike Pena of HRRN. Did you know that the PDJF has no permanent guaranteed funding mechanism and relies entirely on donations from people like you? Please visit the PDJF website at pdjf.org to learn how you can help.
Hi, I'm Ron Turcott. I support the PDJF. I hope you will too. And I thank you.
You're listening to Jock Talk on the Horse Racing Radio Network, presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka.
The pace is increasing as they come to the head of the stretch. It is still Affirmed as they come to the quarter pole. He's holding on to a head lead. Aladar is outside of him and challenging that lead. The two are heads apart, and Aladar's got a lead. Aladar put a head in front, right in the middle of the stretch. It's Aladar and Affirmed battling back along the inside. We'll test these two to the wire. Affirmed under a left-hand whip. Aladar on the outside driving. Affirmed and Aladar heads apart. Affirmed's got a nose in front as they come onto the wire.
Welcome back to Jock Talk, presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka. I'm your host, Christina McManigal, and I am joined tonight by jockey Steve Cawthon. Steve, that was, of course, the replay of your Belmont victory with Affirmed in 1978, your Triple Crown victory. And we were talking about Affirmed prior to the break, and you said that your victory in the hopeful, you realized what a great horse he was. And, of course, he won. He was champion two-year-old colt that year. And so you knew at that point you were sitting on something pretty nice.
Yeah, I mean, I knew he was special. Well, not only, you know, so then he came back down and he beat Aladar Nose in the Futurity, which was another, you know, good, great battle between the two. And then we ran in the Champagne Stakes on an off track, and Aladar got the better of him. He kind of came wide and, you know, got ahead of him, you know, kind of caught him off guard. And the other thing is, you know, Affirm never really loved an off track. You know, that was not his favorite surface. So, you know, as time went on, I learned, you know, came to realize that. But anyway, then we went back up to the Laurel Futurity and we beat him by a neck in that race. You know, there wasn't a great deal between the two. The one thing that we had always was, you know, some tactical advantage, you know. Affirm could do a lot of different things. Aladar kind of had his one style of running. And, yeah, that was just, you know, an advantage that we knew we had and we always tried to take advantage of, you know, anytime we could. And probably a good thing we did because, you know, it was still always tight races.
Definitely worked. So you would say that being able to use that speed when you needed to was pretty much the trick to beating Aladar so many times.
Yeah, I think that was an advantage, you know, a huge advantage, you know, for us. You know, not, you know, the biggest thing was, you know, Firm's heart and his guts and his, you know, but the fact that, you know, we could, you know, tend to get, you know, better position in races and not lose so much ground, you know, be able to get the first, you know, move first if we wanted to, get nick a length or two at the right time, you know, obviously, you know, certainly helped our cause.
So for the Kentucky Derby, Aladar was the 6-5 favorite. You guys, you and Affirmed were 9-5. So mm-hmm. What was your plan going into the Derby?
Well, Laz and I had talked about it. You know, we'd obviously, you know, and yeah, for the Derby, it was a small field. I think there was only 13 horses, but it was a good field. You know, you had Affirmed in Aladar. You had Sensitive Prince, who was an unbeaten horse who'd won, I think, the Florida Derby. And, you know, I think Alan Jerkins trained him. He was, you know, just a real speedball that, you know, had a lot of talent. And there was also Darby Creek Road and Believe It, another really good horse that Woody Stevens had. Yeah, so there were some good horses in the race. But, you know, I think, you know, unlike today, you know, where there's always 20 horses, you know, when with Affirmed and Aladar, I think most people thought, you know, we can't be probably hit the board, you know, somebody's, you know, so it ended up being a smaller field. But, you know, I went into the race basically knowing that, you know, the real race was really between me and Aladar, you know, I mean, I knew that really Aladar and Affirmed were probably, you know, lengths better than the rest of them. He was beating all the horses down in Florida by, you know, massive amounts, you know. And so I guess the real thing that, you know, I was really concerned about was, you know, has he actually improved, you know, since he was a two-year-old? Because we obviously went to the West Coast and he went to the East Coast. And this was the first time we were meeting as three-year-olds. And, you know, I knew Affirm was in great shape and I knew Affirm never did any more than he had to. So that was something I felt like I had, you know, I think people were maybe disregarding us a little bit because we were winning by a couple lengths out in California and, you know, they were acting like the horses out there were, you know, nothing special and, you know, maybe some of them weren't, but, you know, Affirm was only doing what he had to do. And Aladar was winning by 10 and 13 lengths in the bluegrass, you know, so, yeah, you do, and, you know, in the back of your mind, you're thinking, well, you know, if he has improved that much, you know, he may be too tough to beat, but I knew we were going in and, you know, great shape, and so, you know, just optimistic and happy to be there.
So describe the race to us.
Well, the race really went almost, you know, when you plan a race or you think of how a race might go, you know, very seldom do you get it right. But Laz and I had talked about it beforehand, and we knew, obviously, Raymond Earle on the inside was a cheap horse. I mean, not to say cheap horse, you know, but cheap horse, but he had cheap speed for, you know, the kind of horses, you know, we were talking about. And so we thought he might be up there, and we knew, obviously, since the Prince might be up there too, he was drawn on the wide outside, and we were in the post position too. So, you know, the idea was to break, you know, obviously as well as you could, and then either, you know, depending on the pace, you know, if nobody wanted to go or there was no pace, you know, we could do it. I could dictate the race if I wanted to, but most likely we assumed that a couple of those horses might be trying to go on out and, you know, ease back a little bit and just sit, you know, just off of a pace, and then really, you know, try to save myself as much as I could for, you know, for waiting for Aladar. And if everything went, you know, well, I just got eased off, you know, of Sensitive Prince's heels going into the first turn, and I was sitting perfect, and the horse was traveling great, you know. And then Eddie Maple decided to make a kind of a premature move on Believe It. Well, you know, when he moved up to the, you know, the hindquarters of Affirmed, I mean, I didn't even move at all. Affirmed just reacted, and he just took off. And so, you know, we ended up cruising up to the lead and around the two leaders who were stopping. And, you know, I ended up hitting the front sooner than I really wanted to go. But, you know, I couldn't have been going any easier. And it was just then I was just really, like I said, trying to, you know, stay focused, keep my horse focused, because like I said, when he got to the front, he kind of, you know, didn't do any more than he had to, and I didn't want him to get caught napping again like he kind of did in the Champagne. But really, you know, he won. That was the easiest race of the three for him, for sure. For whatever reason, Aladar kind of didn't seem to get geared up until, you know, kind of too late. But when he did get geared up, he came flying. So, you know, he probably made up about, you know, 5, 6, 7 lengths in the last, you know, 3/16 of a mile.
At what point in the race did you realize you had it won?
I think I rode about five strides past the winning post. I think maybe then, but I wasn't taking any chances because I remembered hearing about Shoemaker pulling up too soon, so I wasn't going to do that. But, yeah, I was pretty confident, really, the last probably half a furlong for sure.
And what was that feeling like? Not that long before, you had just rode your first race at Churchill Downs. Didn't do quite so well.
It was,
and then here you are winning the Derby.
Cool. It was cool. It was hard to put it, you know, into words, you know, when it's happening. You know, I mean, obviously, you know, a lot had happened to me in the 2 years between the time I rode my first race there and, you know, the Derby, but you know, it was cool, you know. And again, you know, like you say, and you're coming from, you know, Kentucky, and you know, it's your hometown crowd, you kind of feel like certain people for sure are cheering for you. And you know, I had probably 50 or 60, you know, family members there. And I was obviously, you know, like I said, always my mom and dad, you know, I always wanted to make them proud, and they were, you know, they were always around the race. You know, the racetrack was their life, so, you know, not much more that you can do than, you know, win the Derby for them.
Jockey Steve Cawthon joining me tonight on Jock Talk, presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka, right here on the Horse Racing Radio Network. So, Steve, I'm assuming you guys were pretty confident going into the Preakness.
Yeah, I mean, we were. You know, the horse came out of the race well. You know, it wasn't, like I said, it was, you know, the easiest of the three races for him. So he recovered well, and he went to Pimlico, and, you know, everything was, you know, looking good. And I remember that they breezed Aladar like 6 furlongs and 109 and change or something, some weird, or maybe it was 110. I can't remember, but some freaky fast. Work that they, you know, kind of, you know, showing that they were going to try to get him into the race, you know, crank him up a little more. But, you know, again, it turned out to be a smaller field, you know, and there was, we kind of went into that race thinking, you know, there's a good chance that we'll probably have to dictate this race. You know, I don't want it to be a, you know, sit behind a slow pace. I'd rather be, you know, making the slow pace. So turned out that, you know, that's kind of what happened. You know, after getting around the first turn, you know, I went into the lead and just was able to slow the pace down a little bit and just, again, sit and really kind of wait for Allardyce, you know, Allardyce to be coming. And, but, you know, this time he actually arrived, you know, on time. He was sort of, I could feel him coming, you know, coming around the last turn into the stretch and, you know, and then he was there. But again, you know, I was still full of confidence because I, you know, I knew my horse was just full of run. You know, I hadn't even asked him yet. So, but again, it was kind of reminded me of the hopeful, you know, the way that they, you know, really picked it up, you know, down the stretch. I mean, it was one of the fastest final 3/16 of, you know, any Preakness, I believe, or equaled it. And, yeah, it was just a great finish. And, you know, I knew that, you know, that race was going to take a little bit more out of my horse. I knew through, you know, that probably the next 3 weeks were probably the longest of my life, you know, leading into the Belmont. But, yeah, it was good to get that one out of the way and under my belt. And, yeah, it was on to the final leg.
Yeah, you ended up beating Allardyce by a neck in the Preakness, and as you mentioned, I'm sure that was a very exciting. It had to be a lot of pressure leading into the Belmont.
You know, it was. I think obviously leading into the first two, I was just glad to be there, glad to have the opportunity. You know, you got to win the first one before it even matters, and you know, then you win the second one, but then. Then after you win the first two, then, you know, you actually have a chance to do something. You know, there's a Derby winner and a Preakness winner every year, but, you know, there's not a Triple Crown winner every year. And, you know, to do something that's, you know, very unique. And, I think the pressure was, you know, just I didn't want to be, you know, the one to mess up the, everything was going so good. I didn't want to, at this point, you know, make a mistake. So. I was, you know, probably putting some pressure on myself, you know, which I probably, you know, shouldn't have done, but it's hard not to.
Leading into the Belmont, what did Laz Barrera, what were his plans for training the horse? Was he going to relax a little bit, or did he really push him leading into the race?
No, he really trained him a lot like he did with Bull Forbes. I mean, he just gave him nice, long, slow gallops. I don't even think he worked him. The whole time, you know, the 3 weeks in between, you know, he did some sort of 2 minute licks, you know, he kind of gave him some strong gallops, you know, let him kind of keep his lungs clear, but he never worked. I don't think he physically had him, you know, work. And he gave him long, slow gallops and, you know, kind of 2 minute licks, you know, maybe sort of 3/8 or 1/4 mile, you know, 2 minute licks and kept his wind right. And that's really it. And, he looked good. Yeah. But you could tell he was a little lighter. You know, he's starting to lighten up a little bit. You know, as I said, the Derby trail is tough on horses, you know, and even like a horse, like a firm too, you know, he loved people and, you know, attention didn't bother him, you know, pictures didn't bother, you know, all that stuff was, he was very accepting of and, you know, kind of halfway liked it. But it's a tough trail. It takes a good, you know, it takes a great horse to, you know, actually win the Triple Crown. I too, you know, firmly believe that. And I think, you know, the horses that come up short are obviously, you know, it doesn't mean they're not really, 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 really good horses. But, you know, it takes a horse that's exceptional to, you know, get through all that.
Yeah, it took another 37 years for someone to win the Triple Crown after you and a firm did so. But, Steve, leading into the Belmont, were you at all worried about the mile-and-a-half distance, especially given Allardyce's pedigree and his running style? had to figure to favor Aladar a bit more.
You know, I think, you know, when you're in that position we were in, we had to, you know, we had to trust the horse, you know. I think that's kind of where I was at, is like, you know, we don't know if Affirmed will get a mile and a half. We don't know if Aladar will. You know, I mean, obviously Aladar's style of running makes you think he will. But, I mean, I've seen a ton of horses that were, you know, not that were as good as him, but, you know, horses that, you know, come from off the pace and always finish strong, they don't win the Belmont very often, you know. Yeah. You always got to have speed, you know. Speed, it's like, I think they've asked, you know, Fletcher and Baffert and Lucas and a lot of good trainers, you know, what's the most important thing about a great racehorse? And they always say speed. You know, at some point they got to have some speed, you know. You can be finishing speed, but they have to carry it for a while, you know. And so, you know, I guess what we had to do was, you know, trusting the horse and trusting, you know, the fact that hopefully we could maybe dictate the race a little bit, you know, try to control the pace and, you know, make it the race, you know, suit our horse the best it could, you know. Obviously, we couldn't control what Aladar was going to do, but, you know, as it turned out, you know, I did have a feeling that, you know, if Aladar decided he wanted to go, I was going to let him go, you know. I mean, I was going to obviously follow him, but I wasn't going to, if he tried to push me, I wasn't going to just let him push me. I was going to look at him and say, you know, if you want to go, go. And I knew in my heart that he really probably didn't want to go to the lead, you know. I'm way out, so that was kind of how the race happened, you know. We went to the lead, and then, you know, after a while, Aladar, you know, when we got down the backside, which was still, you know, 7 furlongs to go, Aladar moved up, you know, to me, but I just kind of looked across at Georgie and said, well, hey, if you want to go, go. And I could tell he didn't really want to, so we kind of sat upside each other, and we still ended up going, you know, 6 furlongs and 114, you know, which for those kind of horses is pedestrian. But at some point, you know, going into that far turn, you know, the race obviously had to heat up, and you know, it really, you know, it really took shape, and we were neck and neck, you know, turning into the stretch, and there, you know, it was at that point, you know, guns out and, you know, a-blazing.
Yeah, I did read they did race that fastest last mile in Belmont Stakes history. Pretty impressive. And you went to the left-handed stick, Steve. And wasn't that the first time you'd ever tried the left stick on Affirmed?
Yeah, it was. It was. You know, I really, I mean, I was definitely not left-handed. You know, I obviously learned to use my stick in my left hand, you know, fairly well, but it wasn't my favorite. You know, I was dominantly right-handed, and I had thought about using my stick in my left hand on the firm before, but, you know, it hadn't gotten to the stage where I felt like it was absolutely necessary. And I guess kind of in the back of my mind, I always, you know, was sort of saving it for, you know, a desperate situation. Well, you know, that day it was obvious that, you know, we needed everything we could get. And so finally, you know, I switched sticks and I hit him left-handed, and, you know, he did respond, you know. I don't know if it was totally the left-handed stick or just, you know, his guts, but, you know, Aladar certainly got level with us. You know, they said Aladar got a head in front. I don't know that he really got, you know, his head much in front of me, maybe even with me, but as soon as I hit him left-handed, you know, whatever it was, maybe it was just the shock of never having been hit left-handed before. He, you know, he just got his head back in front, and really from that point on, and that was probably a 16th, you know, at least the 16th or so out, you know, I knew, you know, it felt like we were going to hold on from that point on, you know. It's just like, you wasn't going to let him by. And, you know, it was, without a doubt the greatest race that I've ever ridden in or ridden probably and, been a part of. It was just, a magical, you know, moment, you know, kind of on the biggest stage, which, you know, made it even more special.
Yeah. Affirmed won by a nose, and to watch that replay is just incredible. Like you said, Steve, he was not going to lose. It was just such a determined effort by Affirmed. And crossing the wire, I can only imagine the crowd's response, and if you can put into words, what were you feeling in that moment?
You know, I mean, I was elated. I was, you know, I was obviously happy. I was relieved, and you know, you know, just sort of glad that, you know, I realized that we'd actually got it done, and you know, I was proud of myself and the horse, obviously immensely, and you know, I was, you know, I knew my dad and my mom were up in the stands watching, and my brothers, and you know, that was, you know, obviously the most important thing. And you know, then I was obviously happy for, you know, my team, Laz and the Wilsons and everybody involved. You know, just, it's, you know, you don't realize, you know, it, it's kind of, you know, it's like a football team. You know, there's so many parts to the puzzle, you know, people that play a part, you know, that nobody, you know, gets to see on race day. You know, on race day, it would just appear to be a jockey and a horse, but you know, there's so many more people that, you know, play a part. And so, you know, just really thankful that everybody did their part well.
Well, and you were so young when you won the Triple Crown. And I can only imagine, I think that was such an appeal for people for you because of your age and what you had accomplished. And what kind of attention did that bring of winning the Triple Crown?
You know, I mean, I was getting plenty of attention before that. Obviously, you know, a lot had been going on. I've been winning a lot of races. But, you know, the Triple Crown's kind of, I guess it's like winning a, you know, an Oscar or something, you know. All of a sudden, people think, you know, they think of you on a different, you know, level, I guess. So, you know, I mean, I don't know that it changed the level of attention, so to speak. But I think, you know, people kind of look at you differently as, you know, like, man, that guy, you know, he really, he knows how to do it. Maybe that's just the way you feel people are looking at you, but yeah, you know, I guess maybe it's, that's probably it. It's more how you feel people kind of, you know, accept you in a different way.
So after accomplishing the, just the greatest victory in our sport, winning the Triple Crown, you had an injury. Steve, and talking about the highs and lows of our sport, you've seen them all. And so, of course, unfortunately, you missed the Travers with Affirmed. Yeah. Following the Triple Crown, you missed that race. And that had to be difficult not to to be on the sidelines.
It was, yeah. It's tough to, you know, you get a lot more nervous when you're up in the stands and you can't actually do anything than when you're actually on the horse. So, yeah, that was tough. You know, it was a tough injury in my knee. I fractured my knee. And, you know, I can still say to this day that was the toughest injury I ever had to come back from. And, you know, I broke my neck and pretty much every other bone in my body at one time or another. But, you know, you put your full weight on your knee, you know, and it's just, I probably, you know, was trying to come back a little sooner than I, you know, maybe should have, but, you know, obviously I wanted to get back on the firm. And you know, I think I probably was out for 6 or 7 weeks, I think. But you know, I came back after that and ended up riding Affirmed in the Marlboro against Seattle Slew.
And then didn't you also ride Affirmed in the Jockey Club Gold Cup?
I did.
Against Seattle,
sure.
Slew. And that was an interesting, yep, race. The saddle slipped.
Yeah, that was an interesting race. That was actually the one time, I think, you know, that might have been a sign that the firm was kind of, you know, had a long year and was getting a little tired, because that was the first time ever in a race where he wouldn't relax for me. We broke out of the gate and Angel, I assume, was, you know, determined, decided he wanted to go to the lead. I was trying to get my horse to relax back off of him, but he just kind of, you know, he took a really strong hold and, you know, my saddle just like immediately slipped and went up his neck. And so pretty much from that point on, I was like, you know, water skiing. I couldn't control him or, you know, I kind of was managed to keep my balance, you know, and, you know, stay in the middle of him, but I couldn't ride. I couldn't, you know, I kind of just had to put my hands down on his neck because if I'd have pulled any more, the saddle was going to go off. And then in the end, you know, down the backside, I just kind of had to sit down on him because I, again, couldn't ride.
Yeah, that had to be a nerve-wracking moment when the saddle slips. That's a horrible feeling. But you did make history in both Marble Cup Invitational Handicap and the Jockey Club Gold Cup. The first time that two Triple Crown winners ever faced each other. And pretty remarkable that you got to experience that.
It was. Yep. No, they were both great horses. And, you know, from that, my... you know, assessment, everybody, obviously, you know, after the Marlboro, you know, and Seattle Slew beat Affirmed, I think, 3 lengths in that race. You know, and they said, well, what, you know, what went wrong? And I, you know, the biggest thing that I, my conclusion about it is that, you know, a great four-year-old will always beat a great three-year-old, you know. I think a four-year-old at that stage has got an advantage over a three-year-old. The next year, you know, when Affirmed was running against Seattle Slew, Spectacular Bid, you know, he was beating him. And then the next year when Spectacular Bid, you know, was a four-year-old, he beat everybody. You know, there wasn't another great horse to run with him, I guess, you know, and he was just killing everybody. And I just think, you know, that, you know, a four-year-old, you know, is, you know, just definitely at that stage got an advantage over a three-year-old.
Well, Steve,
if they're, you know, if they're equal talent.
I can't believe it. We are out of time. Affirmed champion, two-year-old champion, three-year-old champion, four-year-old, just remarkable horse. I got to say, we didn't even get to your career in Europe. I would love to have you back again, Steve, to talk about the rest of your career. But thank you so much for joining us tonight.
My pleasure, and we'll have to do that.
Wishing you all the best, Steve. Folks, you can check out this show and replays of all of our other shows on the website. That's horseracingradio.net. While you're there, check out all of the other great shows you can find here on the Horse Racing Radio Network, like Trainer Talk, Equine Forum, Express Bet Radio. Join me next Tuesday at 6 o'clock Eastern Time with another edition of Jock Talk presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka. For our producer, Lee Dalla Pina, I'm Christina McManigal, and thank you for listening.